Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
And the one thing that is at the foundation of democracy is fairness, a feeling that you give your bit, you're part of a greater whole, and the society will look after you. And I think one of the things that came out of World War II was not only a kind of a cult of the individual, which gave us great mobility and freedom, but also shattered the family and the community to some extent.
It created atomization.
An atomization where to the extent we sort of don't even believe in society in America. At the same time, when economic injustice became dramatic, I mean, the statistics are really haunting and unsustainable, I think, for a democracy. 1% of the population controlling $30 trillion of assets, the bottom half having more debt than assets, the three richest men having more money than the poorest 160 million Americans put together. This is really not sustainable.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners, on this edition of the program, one of the world's foremost anthropologists and ethnobotanists joins us to discuss his thoughts on America and the troubles it faces in the age of the COVID-19 pandemic. Wade Davis is the best-selling author of such books as The Serpent and the Rainbow, One River, Explorations and Discoveries in the Amazon Rainforest, Shadows in the Sun, Travels to Landscapes of Spirit and Desire, Light at the Edge of the World, A Journey Through the Realm of Vanishing Cultures, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest, and most recently, Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Colombia. He's also, however, the author of the Rolling Stone article we'll be talking about today, The Unraveling of America, How COVID-19 Signals the End of the American Era. It is perhaps one of the most heartfelt and thought-provoking articles I've had a chance to read since this pandemic began, and I highly recommend heading over to the Rolling Stone website to read it. We elaborate on the major points and themes of that article in the following conversation. And let me just say that I think our conversation will be more than insightful to you, the listener. I believe that it will touch you in some way, as Wade speaks candidly and honestly about his thoughts with regards to the American trajectory. With that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Wade Davis, author of the recently published Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Colombia, and the viral Rolling Stone piece, The Unraveling of America, How COVID-19 Signals the End of the American Era. Welcome to Parallax Views, Wade Davis, noted anthropologist, author of the new book, Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Colombia, which I'm very excited to read in the near future, and author of the Rolling Stone article that came out in August, The Unraveling of America, on how COVID-19 signals the end of the American era. Wade, how are you doing today?
Very well, JJ. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I was actually surprised when I found this article on the Rolling Stone. I had been familiar with your work prior because my dad was a big fan of Serpent in the Rainbow, which I like the book a little bit better than the movie. It's less sensational. And I was surprised because I hadn't heard you talk about political matters before. So what led to you as an anthropologist writing about the unraveling of America in the Rolling Stone?
Well, you know, I think that's exactly the point. It is an anthropologist, in a sense, writing about a country, a culture. I was actually kayaking around our little island here in British Columbia, and I landed on shore, and I ran into a friend of mine, a physician, a brilliant woman, and I sort of blurted out to Trish my thought that, you know, COVID wasn't really a story of medicine. It wasn't a story of mortality and morbidity. It was a story of culture, and she sort of lit up like a light bulb and said, I've been trying to tell all my colleagues that. And I went back that night and I wrote the piece and I sent it to an old friend of mine, Jan Wenner, who founded Rolling Stone. And Jan sent it on to his son, Gus, and it got published on August 6th. The interesting thing about it is that it went absolutely viral. I mean, it was trended on their site for 5 weeks, often at number one. It was read by at least 5 million people on the site, and it had over 350 million social media impressions around the world on the internet. So it touched some kind of nerve about this whole moment in time. And I think that's the interesting thing. You know, pandemics have a way of shifting history. I mean, obviously the Black Death in the 14th century, by killing half the European population, in the end would bring down the medieval order that had been in place for almost 1,000 years.
Some people would say it brought about, you know, something like the middle class. Yeah.
Well, but I was just going to say that, you know, like the Spanish flu in 1918 obviously killed a lot more people than COVID has or will probably, including my grandfather, incidentally. But it came about at a time when the world was numb by death because of the First World War. People forget that in the summer of Woodstock, as 500,000 kids swam around in the mud of that field, Hong Kong flu killed 100,000 people. And in Berlin, they were storing the corpses in the subway stations. The thing is that, again, in 1969, we didn't have international travel. We didn't have the internet bringing immediate communication globally. And COVID, you know, came along, and in killing 2,000 Americans a day, one American dying every minute of every hour of every day, it kind of, America, we all woke up to the fact that, in a sense, we were living in a failed state, you know, led by a dysfunctional government, at the head of which was an individual who was recommending the use of bathroom detergents to treat a disease that intellectually he could not begin to understand. The Irish Times wrote, there have been many emotions expressed about America since World War II, but no one before has ever felt pity. And as primary healthcare workers, frontline workers, awaited emergency airlifts of fundamental supplies from China, the hinge of history opened to the Asian century. And part of the argument is not an argument that is wishing America to fall. In many ways, I think of this, JJ, as a love letter to America. But, you know, we all know that the first step in a family intervention is to hold the mirror to the loved one, to show them how far they've declined. And that realization becomes the first step on the path of rehabilitation. And that's my hope with this piece, is that it will be not something that will put salt into the wound of America, but rather inspire America to once again turn to the better angels of its nature.
It's interesting. I was thinking of your piece about a week ago when the news came out through that Bob Woodward book that, you know, Trump says to Woodward, the big reporter who bust open Watergate, he says, "Oh, Bob, it's bad. This thing's deadly. It's airborne." But then at the same time, he's tweeting about how we have to liberate, you know, all these different states from lockdowns.
Yeah, you know, it's really criminal. I mean, if George Washington famously couldn't tell a lie, this president can't recognize the truth. If Abraham Lincoln, at a moment of true national peril, called for charity for all and malice toward none, I think it's fair to say that Trump has inverted that and seeks malice towards all and charity for none. You know, but this piece is not about Trump, and Trump is not the cause of any of this.
Trump's more of a symptom.
He's a symptom of a certain decline. I mean, I would even argue that, you know, when you flaunt the mask regulations, or when you think you're going to the beach or a concert hall to show your strength or your freedom, I'd almost argue that you're actually displaying the weakness of a people who lack the stoicism to endure the pandemic or the fortitude to defeat it. You know, the election of Trump in 2016 had lots of different causes, but one of the things that I think was disturbing about that election was the fact that the people who voted for him were not a monolith. They ranged across the political spectrum, the economic and social spectrum, the racial spectrum of America. And they weren't foolish or stupid about who he was. And that's what's so disturbing. They knew full well that they were voting their grievances, their indignities. They knew that this, I mean, you couldn't help but know that this was an individual completely ill-equipped for the most powerful and important office in the land. And yet 62 million people chose to vote their anger, to vote for an individual whose only credential was his willingness to validate that anger and target their enemies, real and imagined. And of course, we all vote for people we like or against people we don't like, but we generally pay some attention to their capacity for the job or the essence of their policies. And it's surprising to me that even if you argue that people voted for Trump because he promised to end foreign adventures, to get rid of NAFTA, to return factory jobs to America, or all the host of issues that people were sincerely concerned about, the fact that he's failed on almost all those fronts leaves me a little perplexed as to why his cohort remains so loyal to his electoral ambitions. But I think that the point of this piece is really to ask ourselves, you know, what became of America? You know, on the eve of World War II, America was a demilitarized society. Bulgaria and Portugal had bigger armies. Within 3 years, we had 18 million men and women in serving in uniform. The United States produced more industrial output to save civilization than the nation state of Italy. For every 4 pounds of equipment the Japanese Empire of the Sun got to a frontline troop, America's industrial capacity sent 2 tons across 13,000 kilometers of water. You know, we built Liberty ships and B-24 bombers by the hour. The record for laying down and completing a Liberty ship from start to finish was 4 days, 29 hours, and 17 minutes. And so we emerged from the war with Europe in ashes, controlling 50% of the world's economy, generating 50% of the world's economy, with 4% of the world's population, generating 90% of the world's, building 29% of the world's automobiles. And that affluence allowed for a truce between labor and capital that kind of gave us a middle class, you know, whereby a working man with limited education could support a family and house that family, buy a house, buy a car. And that kind of covenant was a kind of golden age, in a sense, of capitalism. It's not that the 50s weren't periods of incredible difficulty, you know, certainly for women, for people of color, for gay. It wasn't any kind of golden age of American existence. But economically, it was, in a sense, more like Denmark than it is the America of today. Marginal tax rates were 90%. People didn't pay 90%, but the symbol was there that if you're wealthy, you pay your share. I mean, my father-in-law was a CEO for Bell and Howell Company in the 50s, and his salary would have been about 20 times that of a white-collared worker in the company. Now that discrepancy would be more like 400 times. And people who have lived through a time where they've watched women go from the kitchen to the boardroom, and people of color from the woodshed to the White House, gay people from the closet to the altar. You know, you're either comfortable with those changes or you're not, but they do represent profound sociological changes in a generation, kind of the shattering of a certain order of life. And at the same time that those changes happened and needed to be absorbed, people, particularly, you know, uneducated or limited education, white males, were losing their jobs, which were their pride and joy, their means to support their families. So I think in many ways, this all got conflated into a kind of an anger, a sense of being left behind, a sense of unfairness. And the one thing that is at the foundation of democracy is fairness, a feeling that you give your bit, you're part of a greater whole, and the society will look after you. And I think one of the things that came out of World War II was not only a kind of a cult of the individual, which gave us great mobility and freedom, but also shattered the family and the community to some extent.
It created atomization.
An atomization where to the extent we sort of don't even believe in society in America. At the same time, when economic injustice became dramatic. I mean, the statistics are really haunting and unsustainable, I think, for a democracy. 1% of the population controlling $30 trillion of assets, the bottom half having more debt than assets, the three richest men having more money than the poorest 160 million Americans put together. This is really not sustainable. A country that celebrated the freedom of information as the essence of democracy now ranks 45th when it comes to press freedom. You know, we celebrated as part of our mythology the huddled masses. It didn't mean that every immigrant group didn't have to crawl its way on shore, resisted by those who came but a generation before. But at least the myth, and myths are not just about stories, myths are about moral imperatives. They're moral indicators, that they're moral roadmaps, you know, they're ideals. And the myth of the huddled masses was the shining city on the hill. And now we have a great big percentage of the population proposing the building of a wall to keep the desperate out. Desperate men and women who are fleeing conflict zones created by our foreign policies in the 1980s, and of course our cocaine consumption today. And I'd go as far, JG, as saying that to support the building of that wall is not only sort of silly in terms of its limited efficacy, its cost, its violation of private property along the trajectory of it, but in a way it's an act of treason if you think about it. Because what is treason really? It's not just giving a military secret to the enemy. It's also betraying the essence of your dream as a nation, the values of who you are. And in that sense, I think when you turn your back on the city on the hill, the generous spirit of America, you are in some sense denying the essence of what your country is. And I think one of the reasons that COVID, when I say COVID, has reduced to tatters the illusion of American exceptionalism, it's that, you know, the nation has performed so badly. You know, on July 30th of this summer, when the Americans announced 59,629 new cases of COVID in a single day, where I live in British Columbia, right across the border from Seattle, where the pandemic landed, we are a metropolitan, concentrated urban society, which is completely Asian. We have dozens of flights coming in every day from China. Logically, we should have been hit really hard. But on the day that COVID cases soared close to 60,000 in the US, all of British Columbia had but 5 cases in all of our hospitals. So the question we ask is, what was going on in Canada that was not going on in the United States?
So it's interesting because a lot of what you're saying, I think, will resonate with my listeners and also myself. I'm sort of on the Bernie Sanders sort of end of the Democratic Party and sort of political thinking. But you yourself are much more, I guess, conservative. And yet we're both sort of agreeing that social democracy is a good thing. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, you know, I'm conservative because I'm 66, my young friend. You know, it's like you tend to. No, but I mean, it's more like, you know, in a Buddhist sense, I think of the middle way. I don't think of there are no enemies, only solutions. And I think this is something that comes to you with old age, perhaps. Look, social democracy is always seen in America as sort of communism light, when it's nothing of the sort. Social democracy is, in fact, dynamic entrepreneurial capitalism that just focuses on every tier of the society. And one of the things that happens in the social democracy is that there is a sense that everybody's part of something bigger than themselves. You know, healthcare, which the Sanders camp is universal healthcare, which is very much in favor of, I think a lot of Americans don't understand that it's not really about medicine. It's about solidarity, fairness, and justice. You know, in Canada, we really do, at some level, recognize that the wealth of a culture is not the measure of the currency accumulated by the lucky few, but rather the strength of social relations and the bonds of reciprocity that bind everybody into some kind of greater common purpose. You know, our healthcare system is not ideal. For elective surgery, there are waiting lists, and there have to be, because we prioritize the collective at the expense of the individual, and we prioritize the collective certainly at the expense of the private investor who views every hospital bed as if it's a rental property. You know, let me try to put this in perspective. I mean, imagine you're going to get your groceries at Safeway. And I use this allegory in the Rolling Stone piece. When you get your groceries in the United States, and let me just back up for a second, JJ. This is not an anti-American piece. I was born Canadian. I became an American. I married an American. My career could never have happened in Canada. I embrace the wonder of America. I just want America to be, once again, the land of Walt Whitman, Abraham Lincoln, and the Grateful Dead. And my father-in-law was almost U.S. president. My own son-in-law is serving in active duty in the U.S. military overseas as I speak. So this is not anti-America. It's a love letter to America. But going back to Safeway for a minute.
Yeah, I want to get into that. Yeah.
When you get into your grocery store in Canada, you know, the kind of economic, racial, educational class chasm you feel in the States between yourself and the checkout person, it doesn't really exist. It doesn't mean that in Canada you feel that your peers, that you have the same level of education necessarily or the same level of affluence, but you do feel reflexively that you're part of a common purpose, a common community. And the reason for that is very simple. You know that the checkout person knows that you know that they're getting a living wage because of the unions. And they know that you know that probably your kids go to the same neighborhood public school, schools that aren't funded by property taxes that favor the neighborhoods of the affluent, but funded by state or provincial grants that give equal resources to every kid, because every kid has a right to find their dream through education. And the third element is healthcare. You know that they know that you know that if their kids get sick, they will get the same medical care as your kids, and indeed of the prime minister's kids. Now, those strands woven together become the fabric of social democracy. Now, let me give you a very concrete example of that. JG, when my mom was 85, she got a headache on a Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning. By 2 o'clock, and again, I mentioned that in Canada, there are queues for elective surgery, but they're not queues for emergencies. And by 2 o'clock, my mother was about to undergo neurosurgery with the top Indo-Canadian, the top neurosurgeon who happened to be Indo-Canadian. And by the time my sister got to the ICU, my mother was in recovery. He had saved her life, literally. Now, right beside us was another bed with a young girl from a farm in Manitoba, surrounded by her whole Mennonite family. And by chance, that young girl had the same condition as my mom, the same emergency neurosurgery done by the same extraordinary neurosurgeon. And he had saved her life as well. Now, there was a policy at that time in the fanciest hotel in the provincial capital of Victoria, the Empress Hotel, one of the Fairmont chain now, whereby any family member who had a relative in an intensive care unit at any Regional Hospital got a free room in the hotel, which is very generous. So after the nurses kicked us all out of the ICU, this family that we had never met, and my sister and I, we all poured back down to the Empress Hotel, and we went to the bar together. Now, the Mennonites didn't drink, so I bought them milk and juice and tea. My sister and I had a drink, but here was a beautiful thing. If necessary, my sister, a prominent lawyer, and I could have paid for that service. That family would have been forced in any other country like the United States to choose between their economic well-being as a family and the health of their beautiful young daughter. We in Canada reflexively say that's not a choice that any citizen should have to make in a civilized nation. And as we sat together, we toasted not the survival of our loved ones, although that was very much in our minds, not the incredible genius of the surgeon who had saved their lives, although that was also in our hearts. We toasted our country in what I can only say was the purest expression of Canadian patriotism. It was a country that had said that you both are important, both your families. Even though we came from totally different ends of the economic, social, political spectrum, in that moment we were all Canadians and we were in need and our country responded equally. And that gave us a tremendous sense of pride in being part of something greater than ourselves. Now, you know, patriotism is a funny thing in Canada. It's a muted emotion. We, you know, one of our great poets said that, you know, my country is not a country, it's the winter. I mean, you can't wrap yourself in the flag in Canada. It just doesn't happen. But we are deeply content and deeply proud of the nation that we have forged. And that nation is a nation that sees the collective as important as the individual, not to the exclusion of the individual. We're a dynamic, entrepreneurial, wealthy economic nation. But there is a deep sense that society exists, that community exists, and that we owe something to each other.
In regards to the reason I mentioned conservatism was because one thing that has really surprised me today is that people talk about American conservatism, and what I see when I look at, say, Donald Trump or characters like Steve Bannon, who once said that he's for the deconstruction of the administrative state, I don't see conservatism. I see sort of a wrecking ball mentality.
No, absolutely, I think it's you know, I think it's demagoguery, and I think it's fascism in the sense that the real essence of conservatism, and I suppose when you said, you know, I have gone from being a kind of a rabid, you know, kid who spent most of his time in college sort of frankly tearing up railway tracks and fighting against the Vietnam War to someone who recognizes that, you know, conservatism is about maintenance of tradition. It's about honoring tradition. It's about, you know, protecting our forests and our rivers, our landscape. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that some of the greatest American environmentalists have been conservatives. Teddy Roosevelt was progressive in many ways, but he was also a real nationalist, and he was a real believer in the temples of the nation being the national parks, to the detriment of First Nations, I might add. But, you know, Russell Train, the first head of World Wildlife Fund, was a lifelong Republican, promoted to the position of Secretary of Environment, or whatever you call it in the States, by Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon brought us in the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. So it's not, you know, conservatism is not about reactionaries. It's not about destroying things. On the contrary, it's a more subtle philosophy that speaks of a middle way. And I think it's kind of a natural progression that as you get older, you're more cautious about what you've created. I certainly wouldn't describe myself as a conservative or a liberal as much as someone who embraces the middle way. And the middle way, as the Buddhists speak, is really the path of righteousness in a way, you know. But that's an aside. I mean, the point is the article is trying to ask, what is it about America that we have to address? I mean, you know, this cult of the individual. I mean, you know, one of the things when I, you know, this business of the American exceptionalism tatters, you know, the piece is trying to make Americans look at what's become of them. You know, the fact that the divorce rates of the 1960s reached 50%, you know, violating the integrity of the family.
The obesity epidemic
the
obesity now.
The epidemic. I mean, if, you know, if you look at a photograph of Yankee Stadium in the 1940s, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who's overweight. Now it's hard-pressed to find someone who's not just overweight, but clinically obese. And again, this isn't because these are bad people or stupid people. It's because economically, a mom cannot assuage the hunger of four children with fresh food bought in Safeway. It's too expensive.
But well, she's just working so much that she thinks, so I'll go to McDonald's, you know.
Well, yeah. It's partly it's time management, but it's also that money. It's like you know, they're not stupid. They know that they're not giving their kids the best nutrition, but at least the kid's not crying out hungry at 10 o'clock at night. And those carbohydrates will assuage that hunger. So, I mean, again, the average, you know, we celebrate 24/7 as a slogan implying total dedication of the workplace. And then we are surprised that the average American father spends only 20 minutes a day with a child. We shunt off our elders to these retirement homes, separating youth from their grandparents in all but 6% of American homes. You know, we think we're the cat's meow, the shining city on the hill. But the truth is we consume 2/3 of the world's antipsychotic, antidepressant drugs. The main cause of mortality for those Americans below 50 has become the opioid epidemic. After 50 years of a war on drugs and over $1 trillion being spent, we have more people using worse drugs in worse ways than ever before. So you have to look at what has actually become of the culture before you can begin to try to chart a way forward. You know, we celebrate freedom as an individual's right to own a personal arsenal of weaponry, which trumps even the well-being of children. I mean, what kind of country is it that in the year 2019, in the 3 months leading up till April, the people killed each other in such numbers that the mortality rate was higher than that of D-Day on June 6, 1944, when British and Canadian armies assaulted Hitler's Fortress Europe. You know, there's something wrong about that. When our public schools are such that in 15 cities I could name, we don't manage to graduate more than 50% of our senior class. I mean, when you land in airports, you realize that, you know, the third world country has come home and the infrastructure of home is in shambles, in part because we've been spending trillions of dollars in foreign military adventures. Since the 1970s, China's never gone to war. We've never been at peace. At this moment, having gone into World War II, essentially demilitarized, we never stood down. And to this day, American troops are in 150 countries in the world. Since 2000, we spent $6 trillion on military adventures, whereas the Chinese have been pouring their wealth into building the infrastructure of home, pouring more cement every 3 years than America did in the 20th century. So unless we're clear-eyed about where we are, we will never find the path to redemption and recovery. And the election coming up in November, which everybody is putting so much stock in, even if the Democrats, for the sake of argument, have a resounding success, it still won't change the fundamental divide that separates the two halves of the American reality, whereby one draws its news from one source and from itself, and the other draws it from another source and itself, right? You know, we're to the point where one side of the society seems to see the sky being one color and the other seeing the sky as being another color.
There's two parallel realities for two different segments of society.
that are fed in by the media. I mean, you know, everybody on the left loves to show its contempt for Fox News, and it certainly is, in my opinion, for the most part, contemptible. But on the other hand, the voice of the left can be equally smug if you've ever taken time to watch, Chris Cuomo banter back and forth with Don Lemon. I mean, they've taken news into the realm of gossip and sort of pandering in a way that I think is not surprising, that it's offensive to those on the right in the country.
Can I comment on that real quickly?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I know a lot of people in my age cohort, millennials, that grew up on things like Jon Stewart and The Daily Show and now John Oliver. And those are sort of comedy shows, but a lot of people treat them as news. And one of the things that always bothered me about it was the smugness, because I don't think that actually helps us in any way. It doesn't really forge bonds, and it just creates more divisiveness and sort of cultural smugness.
I mean, there's no question about this. I mean, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post, I think yesterday, by a white woman, you know, middle-aged, who said, you know, in 2016, she would never have thought to vote for Trump for all the obvious reasons. But she's beginning to think about it because she's so sick of her little girl coming home embarrassed that she's white. In other words, you know, some of the tropes of the far left are so out of touch with the majority of the people that they almost have to be seen as deliberate irritants, even as they're passed off as signs of progressive liberation. I mean, you know, I teach at a very progressive Canadian university, and the tyranny of the liberal ideology is such that I almost find that, and it's so ironic for me to be saying this because I was an absolute scion of the far left. I mean, I was, you know, within weeks of being at Harvard, I was a member of the SDS, for God's sake. You know, I made, with two friends, we made the last university-wide Harvard student strike. Nobody could have been seen to be more radically to the left than I was. You know, as I went door to door for George McGovern in 1972, reluctantly, because I didn't think he was far left enough. So it's not, you know, it's not like I'm coming from a place of conservative stock. But, you know, things like the whole movement on pronouns, right, that students feel obliged to identify themselves. I mean, no one has been more vocal in terms of the or lived a life of greater respect for women and the rights of gay people, and I couldn't give a damn what someone's sexual proclivity is. I'm a total libertarian. I've been in favor of the ending the war on drugs since the war on drugs began, cynically, under Nixon. But I think some of the ideas of the far left, and I'm not saying Black Lives Matters, but I'm some of the part of the overall miasma of the left is almost conceived to turn off the middle. And that, in the end, isn't very effective politically.
I was going to say, in that regard, I'm fine with things like the whole pronoun debate, for instance. You know, I have a lot of transgender friends who live in the city in Pittsburgh, and I'm fine with that. I think where some people go wrong is they want to use, oh, you didn't use the proper pronoun, to browbeat people that they see as like dumber or unsophisticated or uneducated. Whereas for me, when I talk to people that may not have the same education or may not think the same way, I try to converse with them. And usually by the end of it, we come to an agreement.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I keep going back to the middle of, you know, the incident that got national coverage when a group of largely Caucasian protesters in Washington, under the banner of Black Lives Matter, kind of assaulted or verbally assaulted a young woman in a restaurant, in an outdoor cafe, who turns out to have been very sympathetic with their movement and just refused to raise her hand in as they called it, solidarity with the movement, and then got kind of harangued by people for that. I mean, your heart, if you're in any way in favor of Trump being defeated in November, your heart just broke when you saw that, because it could not have played more effectively into the hands of the Trump demagogues, right?
Do you think that part of this may just be the foolhardiness of, or the sort of, you know, hard-headedness of young people.
You're absolutely right, and that's why I'm so sympathetic with it. I mean, the height of my engagement with radical politics as a student in 1970, I must have been utterly insufferable to my older generation. You know, I remember once, for example, JJ, you know, coming back home to British Columbia and utterly indignant as to what the Americans were doing in Vietnam. And I kind of had this burst of emotion in the garden with my father and sort of screamed at him, like, you know, they're killing children. Don't you know they're killing children? And, you know, and I'll never forget the look at my father's face when I said that. It was a look of sort of pity, world weariness. And I suddenly realized I was saying to a man who had lived through the Second World War, you know, who had lived through the Depression, who had had his parents killed in 1943, and I was like this young, irritating activist accusing my father of not knowing pain. And his look said, you know, I love you, son, and welcome to the bloody world. You know, and it was really a powerful moment for me. So I think I'm very sympathetic and very understanding of young people, as long as they're respectful. And but at the same time, politically, it can be less than helpful at times. But again, it's like, you know, if I wasn't focused on and concerned about the fate of America, I wouldn't have written this piece in Rolling Stone.
Before we wrap up, I just had two more things I wanted to quickly mention. The first is, you mentioned this idea of sort of like this conception of freedom that actually atomizes us. I've been toying with the idea that I think there's a connection between freedom and equality. And I think when you have, you know, stratification where there's extreme income and wealth inequality between different classes of people, I think it actually makes us all less free in a way.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think this is the essence of the argument for social democracy, is that it's not a political issue. It's not about the right and left. It's about quality of life. And when, you know, the American myth of the limitless pie has driven the society so well, but when you get into these situations of inequality and economic injustice, it begins to echo, in a sense, almost a more of a Latin American model, where there's always been, you know, this sense of the pie is limited and what my family gets, you know, someone else is, you know, isn't going to get, kind of thing. And, you know, if you look at a country like Denmark, the quality of life is demonstrably better, and it's better for everybody. And it doesn't mean that Denmark's some kind of socialist country. It's a dynamic democracy, as I write in the Rolling Stone piece, where actually people work longer and harder for greater rewards and pay more tax, yes, marginally more tax, but they get something for it. You know, free education, maternity leave, 6 weeks of paid vacation, all kinds of things that are all about the quality of life. And the question has to always become, you know, is your economic political system giving you the quality of life that you want? And the economic injustice, the discrepancies of incomes in the United States, I think ultimately is unsustainable. Look, I mean, America's gone. The point isn't that America's over, really. America's always swung between extremes. That's part of its sort of allure, right? And all the article is really saying that America right now, as it did in the 1920s, has swung to a extreme where the economic injustice is no longer tolerable and acceptable if the country is going to remain united in any way. And I think that's really the point of the piece. It's like a wake-up call, you know? I mean, it certainly isn't looking forward to the end of America. You know, if and when America does pass the torch to Asia and a nation state like China, with its treatment of democracy, ethnic minorities, its social capital or credit system to gauge and dominate and define the proper behavior of its citizenry, we will be nostalgic for the best years of the American century. You know, America is the country of the Grateful Dead. It's a country of Walt Whitman, and it's a country of Abraham Lincoln. And it can be that again, but it's going to take reaching out across this divide and finding a middle way.
Last thing I wanted to mention before we close out the program. I mentioned earlier that I first came across your work with the great book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was about Haitian zombies, essentially. And it was interesting because that book really informed me later on in life in a strange way, because I saw the movie, the Wes Craven movie, which is very sensational. Oh, look at these scary Haitian people. And the book was so different than that. The book really wasn't sensational, and it sort of treated people as human beings, even people from different cultures than my own. And it really sort of forced me to rethink the xenophobia we see in our culture and our media. I was wondering if you could comment on... Well,
that's really the role of anthropology. You know, Ruth Benedict said the real purpose of anthropology is to make the world safe for human differences. You know, the great revelation of modern American anthropology is that, you know, the world into which you're born is just one model of reality, and the other peoples of the world aren't failed attempts at being you, let alone failed attempts being modern. Every culture has something to say. Each deserves to be heard, just as none has monopoly on the route to the divine. You know, every culture is, in a sense, a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the peoples of the world answer that question, they do so in the 7,000 voices of humanity. And in all of my books, JG, 23 of them now, I've always been driven by sort of some sense of justice or some wrong to be addressed. I mean, in the case of the Voodoo book, I use the zombie phenomena as an entry point to ask the obvious question. Why is it that we describe voodoo as a black magic cult when it's simply the distillation of very profound religious ideas from West Africa? Why do we deny the reality that the obvious ethnographic fact that the peoples of Ecuador, West Africa had religious beliefs, right?
There's also a lot of ties between the Haitian voodoo and Catholicism. I grew up Catholic, so I know.
Well,
about
I mean, the expression in Haiti is, you know, the nation's 90% Catholic and 110% voodoo. But even with my new book that just came out yesterday, Magdalena, River of Dreams, it's kind of a biography, almost a love letter to Colombia. But again, it's driven both by a desire to present the truth about that country as opposed to the dark cliches, but also to sort of, you know, remind people that Colombia has, yes, endured a 50-year war in which 220,000 people died, 7 million were internally displaced, but that war would not have lasted a day had it not been fueled by the profits of the cocaine trade. Most Colombians have never seen, let alone used, cocaine, but they've been the innocent victims of a war in which, you know, the total number of fighters of 200,000 in a country of 50 million. And so the country is not a place of violence and war. It's a place of colores y cariño, of the greatest natural beauty on earth, the greatest biological diversity, ecological and geographical diversity. And you know, it behooves us to remember that this war was caused by our consumption of cocaine. And ultimate responsibility for Colombia's agonies in good measure lies with those who use cocaine and governments that prohibit its use, allowing for a black market about which the governments do nothing to curb their interests or the existence of the market. And so, you know, in the last year before the signing of the peace agreement in 2016, the leftist group, the FARC, down to maybe 6,000 cadre, mostly teenagers in search of a meal, made $600 million from cocaine. Now, if you give me the San Antonio Boy Scouts and $600 million, I can wreak havoc in southern Texas, right? And so, you know, rather than thinking of Colombia as a land of narcos, we should be thinking of it as this extraordinary place where, despite a war imposed upon it largely by drug profits that were such, the Medellin cartel, JG, budgeted $1,000 a week to buy elastic bands just to wrap the money in. You know, this is a country we should be celebrating for its both its natural beauty, but for the fact that despite the conflict, It managed to maintain its civil society and democracy, green its cities, create millions of acres of national parks, seek restitution with indigenous people unlike any other nation state, and has quietly, unlike the United States, which turns away desperate mothers at the Mexican border or puts their children into cages, the Colombians, at a time when they need every possible dollar to pay for the implementation of the peace agreement, in a time when oil revenues, their main source of foreign currency, have plummeted, they have quietly accepted 1.8 million Venezuelans, refugees, who have been housed, fed, given medical treatment, and educated. This tells you something about the true spirit of the Colombian people.
You know, Wade Davis, I really want to thank you for coming on the program. I want to give you a chance to let my listeners know how they can get the new book. But I also wanted to say real quickly, because I always like to end on a positive note, if possible, do you think there's a way out of this? Do you think that there's a way to overcome xenophobia and things like that and realize that, you know, we are all sort of, we're human?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is the ultimate message of anthropology, is in one way of thinking about that is go back to the values of the 19th century, what people thought about the role of women, the fact that in 1911, the Oxford English Dictionary did not even have an entry for racism or colonialism or homosexuality, for that matter. The certainties that Edwardian Europeans accepted, not one of those would we accept today. And so if you're a young boy who doesn't think twice if you're white having a black girlfriend, or if you think it's completely normal for two men or two women to have a loving family as long as there's love in the household, or if you understand what it means when a young African American woman says, "I am the monument to the Confederacy. It's my ancestors that were raped by overseers. My mixed blood is your monument." If you understand what that means, you are a child of anthropology, because all of these social movements for women's rights, for racial justice, economic justice, they were driven by politics and the sacrifice of activists. But the fundamental intellectual grounding for those movements, the ideas that shattered the European mind, shattered the old orthodoxy, came out of a small group of contrarians led by Franz Boas, Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, Zora Neale Hurston. These were the early American anthropologists. And for their radical ideas that, you know, manners don't make the man, men and women make the manners, that your culture is just a reflection of its own history, etc., they were hounded from positions, chased by the FBI, and really, really were pioneers. And they sowed the seeds of what we now know to be modernity when it comes to these issues. So, of course, I'm optimistic. Pessimism is an indulgence, despair an insult to the imagination, orthodoxy the enemy of invention. Good and evil coexist in the world, the Buddha would say. We'll never get rid of the latter, but we must embrace the former. And the goal isn't to vanquish evil, as the Christian church suggests it to be, which has always been our desperate illusion, but rather to push the side of righteousness, knowing full well that the goal is not the elimination of evil, but the triumph of good. And the destination in life is not a place, but a state of mind of the pilgrim, in which you can look back at a long life and realize you've been the architect of your life. You've made your choices. You haven't indulged choices imposed upon you. And in that sense, you've accomplished the most challenging goal of a life, which is to be the architect of your own life. And that's why I always say, JG, to young people, never compromise, be patient, and give your destiny time to find you.
And how can my listeners get a copy of the new book, Magdalena?
Oh, Magdalena will be available on Amazon and every single outlet and every bookstore across the country, published today or yesterday by Knopf. And I encourage those, especially those with an interest in Latin America, I think will very much enjoy the book.
Well, thank you again, Wade Davis, for providing such an insightful conversation on Parallax Views. Thank you.
My pleasure. God bless you. Take care, son.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with anthropologist and ethnobotanist Wade Davis, author of the riveting new book, Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Colombia, and the excellent must-read viral Rolling Stone piece, The Unraveling of America, How COVID-19 Signals the End of the American Era. If you haven't read it yet, please check it out. Link in the show notes. If you haven't been able to read it so far, check it out. Like I said, must read. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Gratz, Zach, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, head on over to patreon.com/parallaxviews. Join at the $10 or $15 tiers, and you can get your very own producer's credit on every edition of Parallax Views. It is you, the paying listeners, that keep this project going 4 episodes a week for a while now. I hope to keep that level of production going, maybe even an extra episode or two during the election season. But I need your help. Parallax Views listeners, please support me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews, where at the $5 tier, you can listen to the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, with yours truly, JG, the human podcasting machine, and my pal, Comrade Casey, as we go through some of the news stories you may not have considered in the past week. You may have missed it. Well, we do deep dives, folks, into some of the stories that we consider worth noting. All that and more on the Parallax Views Patreon page at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views, to Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.